and welcome to Sauce and Bomb Podcast. I'm your host, Anna Dana, Head of Growth at Sauce Group, serial acquirer buying wonderful sauce businesses to take them to the next level. And here I chat with inspiring founders and experts to get an inside scoop on how they made their business a success. And today with me is Anthony, founder and CEO of DN Simple, a hosting and domain management automation solution. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Anna. I appreciate it.
Sure, anytime. So, you know, companies bootstrap, you have a super lean team. It's a great story. You've been operating for almost 15 years now, and I can't wait to like dig a little deeper. But before we go there, maybe let's start with your background and how you got to do it in the first place.
Sure. So I actually worked for one of the first seven domain registrars in 1999 when the .com domain was deregulated. So there used to be one company that had the monopoly on .com domains. And when that was split up so that folks, anybody else could register, I was the CTO at one of the companies that had the rights to sell those domains. So that was really at some of the early days of the commercialization of domain names. And for some reason, I've been dragged back into it many times over my career. And what was happening is in 2010, I was just finishing up a startup that never really took off. We didn't get another round of funding. I was the CTO at that company as well. And so I was using another domain registrar and I was really getting frustrated with their DNS interface. And I said, okay, I've been doing this at the point, it was 17 years. This was in 2010. I said, I really need to try out my hand at running a company. And so I said, I'm going to build a DNS company first. And the goal would just be to be able to manage DNS. And so wrote the first line of code in April. So April 1st, 2010, launched July that same year. So that's 3 months later at RubyConf, where I gave a 5-minute lightning talk demonstrating how I could do through a command line interface some things with the service. And then that same year started selling domains as well, because people that were using the service said, oh, you know, the DNS part's great, but we'd really love it if you sold domain names as well. Started doing that. And that kind of just kickstarted the growth of everything.
That's pretty cool. It's great to hear that, you know, you're also coming from the Ruby community. And I always joke when, you know, there is a founder here who is exposed to Ruby community is, you know, the question of like, how did you make it a success is just, you know, a stupid one, because everyone just says, oh, you know what? I just reached out to the community and they were supportive and everything kind of worked. Like, seriously, the story of every founder here.
Yeah, especially the early days of the Ruby community was an extremely solid community that was very supportive. And there's no doubt that both the language and the community as a whole were key parts, I think, in the initial success of DN Simple. Because that was the community I was in. I was actually going around and speaking at events, talking to the Ruby community, talking to folks about Ruby on Rails. And so it worked out that helped the company go.
Do you still do that? Are you still active in the community?
Yes. So I'm less active now than I was before. I still have given talks from time to time. We do a lot of sponsorship of events and sponsorships of local Ruby meetups. So, for example, we sponsor the Boulder Ruby Meetup in Colorado. We've sponsored events. We sponsored conferences throughout the year, basically. Small, usually more regional conferences.
Okay, I see. Okay, so you started with really like a simple little problem that you were trying to solve for yourself. How did it grow from there? When did you start getting the team together? And to be honest, I also wanted to ask you, because there is another company on your LinkedIn profile, and it says original organization that developed the DN Simple application. I was wondering if that was kind of the service company that you had prior to the product that was later, you know, also the source for you to bootstrap.
Yeah, you've nailed it on the head, actually. So Atrion LLC was my personal consulting company that I started with. And so I developed DN Simple initially under that. It was a Florida LLC, but at one point the LLC was too limiting. We wanted to be able to open up just in case we wanted to take outside funds, although we never did. It just gave us options that we wouldn't have had otherwise. And so in 2018, I sold the LLC to the Dinsable Corporation, which is a Delaware C Corp. And that allowed us to essentially make a little bit more of a solid company that would be able to grow over time. And so it was just a structural change in a lot of ways, but it was also kind of saying, okay, here's a breaking point where we did business one way and now we're going to do business a different way as well. In terms of the actual timing of the company, when I started in 2010, it was myself and my brother. I handled all of the software development and he handled sort of the server operations and the deployment of software to those servers. And then in 2012, we acquired a one-man company that was inside of it was kind of adjacent to our industry. It was in the domain industry, but he was doing a lot of things with Whois, which is a way of looking up information about domains history and domains. It's actually just been, in terms of a protocol, it's actually been deprecated now, and we're switching to something else in the world of domains. But we acquired his company, and he was the first employee. At the time, I wasn't even an employee. I wasn't taking a salary. So I went the first 3 years, and I was actually the third employee or the third team member, if you will, with the first one being the person we acquired, his company, the second being my brother, and then finally me. And then in 2014, my brother decided to go do other things. That was kind of the catalyst to kick off hiring more team members, and we kind of grew from there. We stabilized around, I would say, 8 to 10 people for quite a long time. And that took us all the way out to, I would say, 2017, 2018. And then as we restructured the company, as I sold the LLC to the C Corp, then we started growing a bit more and have been steadily growing since then with customer support folks, with sales folks, with more engineers. So it's kind of been a very organic process of growing the company. It was never really planned in any particular way. We just kind of each year looked at it and said, okay, what do we need to do this year? Where are we missing folks? Where do we feel too much pressure? Maybe where are we not feeling enough motion? So we're going to hire some folks to see if we can get some motion in that area.
Yeah. And I feel like, well, if you look at the history of the company, like how many years you've been operating, now you have 25 people. So you were adding like, I don't know, 0.7 people per year. That's a pretty steady growth.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's slow, but we definitely, when I started Dinsable, the goal was not to be one of those companies that hired really quickly and tried to raise a bunch of money. Like, it was very much a conscious decision to create a business that would be a profitable and sort of steady growth business rather than a attempt to shoot for the moon.
Okay, I see that. So yeah, let's maybe talk about this whole, you know, shift from consulting company to the product and how you approached it, and at what point you didn't have to rely on the consulting company anymore, and you know, you bootstrapped your way to profitability.
Yeah, so during the first couple years of Dinsable, when I started it, I was doing independent contract work. So I was writing software on a contract basis for other folks, and I was going out and looking for that business. At that point in time, actually, so I was in Hawaii when it started. That's where the other startup was that we were closing down. And my wife and I decided we're gonna move with our four kids back to France because my wife is French, and we're like, well, we want the kids to get an education in France. So I moved to France working as an independent consultant for the first year or two. And then I had an offer to go work at Living Social, which at the time was competing head to head with Groupon, and they were hiring like crazy. And I knew a lot of the engineers who were working at Living Social. So I said, okay, I'll go ahead and take that job. And I had them carve out the rights to Dinsable in the contract. So it was clear this was something I was running and working on and that they didn't have any rights to it. And they were fine with that. And so then I spent the next couple of years as I was growing Dinsable working for them remotely. So they were mostly in Washington, D.C. I was in France. And actually had a really, like, it was a good experience because I was able to work full time for them and then work on the weekends and the evenings developing and growing Dinsable slowly but steadily. At one point, Living Social said, well, we're closing down our French offices. So that's the point where I basically said, okay, I'm going to go work for Dinsable full time. It was kind of, again, very organic and natural. It was the flow of that business combined with Dinsable, and it just kind of all worked out pretty well.
That's great. Yeah, that's kind of like your classic SaaS founder story that you want to hear. Evenings and weekends and bootstrapping and, you know, keeping the job. But back to bootstrapping, like, are there any rules? Were there any rules before, like, you know, when you were starting, like, I don't know, when you spend and what the priority is, and how did that mindset and approach change over the years?
I mean, initially I was writing something that I wanted. And so the majority of my time was spent figuring out, okay, what do I want to improve here? And that was very in the very beginning, but it very quickly became, well, okay, I did what I wanted to do. Now I wonder what other people want me to do. And in fact, the decision to add domain registration was after I did a poll of people on Twitter who I knew. So from my community, I sent out a poll and I said, would you like us to sell domain names? And if so, which domain names would you like? It was something along those lines. And there, it was a resounding yes. And so that kind of triggered the push to do the domain registration part. And then again, I'm going to sound like a broken record, but a lot of the growth and development came from feedback and came from sort of a natural progression for what the customers needed. I kind of just was the catalyst to start it, writing just the core. But then it was just like, hey, can you add this to it? Can you add this to it? Can you do this? This doesn't seem to work the way I expect, you know? And it just basically became feedback from the customers that grew it. Now, that growth was fairly quickly in the beginning, but it also started to sort of level off. And it was really when it started leveling off that we started getting a little bit more strategic about it and saying, okay, what should we build to grow our revenue stream? So for example, we had added support for SSL certificates, but at this point I had the person who I bought their company had become the CTO, and he said, oh, we really ought to support Let's Encrypt. And so we started adding Let's Encrypt. And once we had that, we said, oh, what would be cool is if our URL forwarding could have Let's Encrypt and make it so that it was automatically HTTPS. And if we do that, we can put that feature in our higher tier. And so it was that kind of thinking that helped guide the decision-making process on which features. We're like, let's look at features that add enough value so that folks would actually move up to a tier that we would consider more, you know, prosumer or business level.
Yeah, I see. I'm just wondering, you know, and maybe I'm just like way too deep in that AI bubble already, but you know, you guys were a super small team, still are. And how are you managing, you know, all of it, customer communication and building the product and, you know, changing the pricing and everything. But it's, you know, probably the customer communication, customer success is something that I'm most interested in.
This episode is sponsored by Rewardful. Looking for new ways to find customers for your SaaS business? Consider building an affiliate program. Rewardful is the easiest affiliate tracking platform to set up, manage, and scale for SaaS companies. Building a successful affiliate program can be a little bit intimidating at first, and that's why Rewardful has taken what they've observed from their most successful customers' affiliate programs and distilled that into an exclusive online course. The exciting part? Their affiliate marketing course is absolutely free. Start the course at academy.rewardful.com. Academy.rewardful.com. And turn your biggest fans into your best marketers.
So from the very beginning all the way till now, all of our engineers, in fact, everybody at the company has access to the customer support queue and is expected to answer support requests. So originally we would have all messages coming to a queue, and team members would pick elements off that queue that made sense to them. And so that worked for quite a long time. And then we started hiring a couple of folks to help sort of triage and do certain types of support. So there were common support questions that weren't really technical. They might be something related to billing or something that needed to be done that couldn't be done with the software. And then they would triage everything that was a technical question and assign it to an engineer, or they would assign it to sales, or they would assign it to marketing. And this is how we still do it today. Essentially, all of us are on the hook for answering support requests each day. And that is what created a way to communicate with the customers. It obviously, like when you have that requirement for everybody to support, they feel the pain that is top of mind of the majority of customers. And so we would take that and then we'd basically keep a long list of stuff that they wanted. And we would use that as the sort of the cue to take things off of to decide what to build. And balancing it between fixing things and then building new things. And so we were kind of always trying to strike a balance. And sometimes we would go more on one end and sometimes we'd go more at the other end. But even today, we try really hard to strike a good balance between keeping things running smoothly and building new functionality.
All right. And also, you know, to be honest, keeping your marketing and your copy super fun. Like I went to the website and I was like, okay, well, these folks, first of all, know what they're doing. And second, yeah, really seems like you guys are having fun with it because, you know, first of all, like I'm going to be very honest with you. I'm the least technical person on earth. And it was kind of like...
I highly doubt that.
Okay. Yeah, well, maybe slight exaggeration, but still. And yeah, I was kind of reading through your documentation, the blog post, and I was like, oh, all right, well, that's fairly understandable. And then, you know, I found the comics and I went through those. And yeah, like I spent reasonable or maybe not so reasonable amount of time on your website. So yeah, I wonder how you landed there. Like, what's the approach here? Like, I don't know, doing all of it, like really simplifying it for folks like me, but at the same time, having this layer of support from your engineers who actually speak the language that's a bit more advanced than mine.
So we have the comics and a lot of the feel, sort of that fun, actually comes from one particular team member who has been a member since 2017, I believe. And he is both a designer and a software developer. And he loves building fun stuff. And so over the years, he would introduce these ideas and just take them to the fruition. So for example, how DNS.works, which is the comic that he developed, he wrote all of that. He came up with all the copy, all of the images, and said, I have this idea to have this web comic. And he shared it with us. And we said, wow, this is really cool. He did like the first episode or two of the web comic. And I said, keep building this, let's finish it. And so he created 7 separate episodes of this webcomic. And then we were like, this is great. Let's just keep tying this in because we had been looking for a mascot and the characters from the comics just seemed like obvious choices. And so we rolled with it. And I think along the way, he and I and other team members as well, we just often seen, we're running a business, but at the same time, we've seen the opportunity to have some fun with it and just took it, you know, did April Fool's jokes for the fun of it, just had a good time because that's part of running a business. It's not all about, oh, I have to make all this money and I have to do this. It's also about having a little fun along the way, making sure that your customers are having a little fun too. You probably didn't have a chance to get an account and get into DN Simple, but on our domain management, like on our DNS management page, if you scroll down to the bottom, there's actually a little Easter egg there that's a music player. And when you play, it plays your DNS records as music. And that came out of an April Fool's joke that we were messing with. And it was so popular that we could never remove it. In fact, I've had people say, look, love your service. Please don't ever remove the music player because it's just such a fun diversion. You're sitting there doing probably one of the most mundane things you can do, which is manage your DNS. And at one point during the day, you just go, oh, I'm just going to press this button and see what happens. And people have a good time. And I want people to have fun with it because, you know, we're not here just to make a buck. We're actually here to do something that's enjoyable and to make people smile a little bit.
That's awesome. Yeah, that's exactly what I thought. Like when I knew that we were going to do a podcast, I was like, oh my God, first of all, I will probably never understand what you actually do. And second, well, let's be honest, it's probably going to be boring. And then I went to the website and I was like, okay, It's actually a ton of fun. Like, let's talk about this. But, you know, I also went and listened to a couple of your previous podcasts. And you started talking about the team. And there was a quote that I really, really liked. And I'm going to ask you about, you know, scaling and also the team. And, you know, you were in this kind of founder mode first, doing everything, you know, but then you said you kind of moved on to making sure the company operates well and there is money in the bank and we have a great team to support it. So I want to ask you, first of all, about that shift, because there are a lot of posts on LinkedIn and blog posts and whatnot about the fact that, you know, as a founder, first you hire those, you know, 0 to 1 kind of people, so more of a generalist, and then once you start scaling, you want to have the experts there. And I was always kind of questioning, okay, but if you are a 0 to 1 founder, because there are a lot of those, and, you know, in fact, like those are the companies that we buy when the founders just want to take the company to a certain level. How do you even know when to move out of it? How do you even know how to drag yourself from this one stage to another? So what was your journey? How did you move from, you know, the startup to scale up?
That's actually a really good question. And I think the trigger for me came around the technical operations side. So there's always going to be a catalyst. And inside of Dan Simple, the catalyst was when we got to I mentioned we all do customer support. There's also another thing that we've always done with the engineering team, and all of our engineers are on call. So we have an on-call rotation, and every single engineer, if they have access to our production systems, has to be on call. We don't have a team that is alerted when something goes on fire, you know, or there's a problem. It's an on-call person who can then escalate it to the entire team. And there became a point where I realized that I didn't know enough about the software anymore. I wasn't involved enough anymore to be able to be in that on-call rotation. I had started focusing more on marketing and sales and really looking at the strategic direction of the business. And when I got to that point, when I saw myself unable to really grasp the big picture of the technical details, I said, you know, it's time for me to step back. So I told the team, I said, you know, you all are doing a fantastic job with operating this. I don't need to be on call anymore because I'm not writing software as much anymore. I'm running the business. And therefore, I removed myself from the on-call rotation. And I said, I'm also taking the CTO off the on-call rotation because I need him to be my strategic technologist. And that was it. And that was kind of the catalyst for that switch. It took the CTO still involved in the technology. So for him, not being on call isn't necessarily that he won't be available, but it gives him the space as well to try to stop thinking about the low-level details of how software works and instead focus on the high-level details of where we want the technology and the business to go in the future. So that's kind of it. Pretty straightforward, but it didn't happen overnight. It just was like a slow development as I got less and less involved in writing software and more involved in making sure that we had the elements you mentioned before. We had the financials proper in the bank. We had the team operating well. And essentially I was focusing on the business as a whole.
Yeah, that makes great sense. So let's talk about, you know, that great team to support it. And I'm wondering, like, who you're looking for, because you're 25 people, about $7 million in ARR, and it seems like your folks are super happy and empowered to do what they want to do. So yeah, if when you're hiring that 0.7 people per year, who are you looking for?
So first of all, we're looking for somebody who is really interested in working in a distributed and remote environment, because we're a fully distributed team and we're fully remote. We're asynchronous. We do the vast majority of our work through Slack and GitHub. And so the first thing we're looking for is somebody pretty much anywhere in the world who is comfortable in that environment. And usually it's because they have some experience in that environment. Maybe they worked in a hybrid environment and they see some of the challenges when you're trying to mix hybrid and they're like, I'd really like to go fully remote. Maybe they've successfully worked remotely for a couple of years. I think that's a key part because you do have to have kind of, you have to be ready for the challenges that come working across all these disparate time zones. And so we look for people that can communicate well through writing, who are going to be proactive. And this was especially, I would say early on, but even now we're looking for people that are going to be proactive, not just reactive. They can't wait for somebody to give them instructions. They have to be part of the generation of those instructions, the communication and the when those things commence. We don't look for, like, we can't afford people that are at the top end of the salary spectrum. So I can't afford an engineer that costs $300,000 to $400,000 a year. No business at 25 people making $7 million in ARR can afford that level. So we also have to find somebody that's willing to accept that, that work is a trade-off. You're trading your time for money, right? And so if you really want the big payout, you're going to probably have to invest a massive amount of your time. And that's where you hear those stories of, oh, we need our engineers to work 80 hours a week and do that nonstop, you know, month after month after month. That's not Dean Simple. We say, look, you need to work. If you make commitments, you need to keep those commitments. But I don't expect you to work a crazy number of hours and burn yourself out. I expect you to spend time with your family. I expect you to travel. I expect you to have a life. And then I expect you to show up when you're needed to show up and be there. If you're on call, for example, then be on call and be present. But if you're not, it's okay. Like, there's a team there to back you up if something goes wrong with software that you wrote. The same for the customer support team. We have them in two different time zones, so that they don't have to get this feeling like, oh, I have to be checking my phone all the time or checking the inbox. I want them to go and do a good day's work and then say, yeah, I'm happy. This is good. I did the things I committed to. Our customers are happy. I know what's going on. I can cut off for the day and have the rest of the day to myself. So I think those are some of the key elements. So people that are comfortable working remotely, people that understand that there's a trade-off of time and money. And at Dean Simple, we may not pay as much as someplace else will, but we'll definitely respect your time far more than most other companies will.
Sounds Group is partnering with SoundsTalk USA, taking place May 13th to 14th in Austin, Texas. This is where heads-down SaaS founders and their teams move their business forward. As a partner, we have 30% discount available to share with our network. Use code SaaS Group 30 in all capital letters, and see you there.
That sounds like a great culture, honestly. And, you know, throw in the remote and asynchronous, and I think you'll get yourself quite a few folks that, you know, would really love to have that setup. I mean, we are also the same at SaaS Group, and a lot of people just notice how, you know, how amazing it is and how life-changing sometimes it is, because we've had companies that we acquired that were coming from an office environment. All right. Well, I obviously have questions about AI. I mean, I don't remember the last time when I had an episode without them. So, tell me if you guys are also working, because I couldn't find anything. Like, there is no word AI on the website, I believe. I don't know. Maybe I wasn't diligent enough.
Yep. That is, I think you are correct. No, you're correct.
Okay. Oh, good. All right. How did you do that? How are you so brave not to?
So a lot of the companies that have added AI to their name or what they do or what have you are, they think they're going to miss the bandwagon if they don't. There is a lot of FOMO going around, a lot of fear of missing out, right? And I've been working with the internet since the earliest days of the web browser. I started in 94, really, when it was Mosaic, and it was the early days of the web browser. And I can tell you this, that it's, while it's a shift and it's going to be massive, it doesn't mean that you have to jump in without a plan. And so at Dean Simple, team members have been experimenting with AI behind the scenes. We've been experimenting with a variety of ways of using. We've also seen how it can be used very wrong. So we had some initial experiments that were just, we never put them out for our customers, it was for internal use, but we wanted to see, for example, how it would work. We had team members who would see how it would work for writing prose, you know, like they wanted to write a blog post using generative AI. And some of the first iterations were pretty terrible. You could spot them like that. It was very easy. And so we basically said, look, there's a couple things we need to do first before we even consider this. The first is we need a safe usage policy. Like, we can't even consider putting our customer information until we have that in place. And I think a lot of companies may have just jumped and said, oh, we're going to do this right now, because if we don't, we're going to fall behind. And maybe if you're in the race to raise funds or to pump your stock up on the stock market, yeah, I can get it. We don't have those requirements. Our only requirement is that we deliver our customers the value that they expect from us. And so we didn't feel any pressure to inject AI into our website immediately saying, oh, now we have AI this and AI that. Instead, we're taking a very measured approach to it. Now, it is on our, we do have objectives and key results for the year. And it is one of the three objectives for the year, which is to determine what place, if any, generative AI has at DN Simple. We see some interesting potential use cases for it, both to empower our engineers to be able to develop things faster, with an understanding that generative AI is a tool, and a tool used incorrectly can cause a lot of damage. So we have to train ourselves on how to use the tools well, and we have to apply human responsibility to the outcomes that we create from those tools. But in that, if we have that framework and we have those boundaries, there's no doubt that it's going to potentially make certain things happen a lot quicker for those engineers that know how to use it well and know how to spot the areas where maybe it didn't get something right. And so we're looking at it, but we're not going to rush and put it in all of our marketing, because why? It would just, it's there for marketing purposes to get more traffic? No. No, that's not something we do at DN Simple. We focus first on how do we deliver what our customers actually need. Now, if a customer or if a number of customers came to us and all had the same thing, they said, wow, I really need this with generative AI and domains put together. Please build it for us. Then I guarantee we'd be looking a lot harder at it.
Okay, that makes sense. And, you know, it's very interesting that you said that you have, you know, a few objectives for the year, and then you go back to them and kind of reassess them and see if they even make sense. And I was wondering, you know, one of the questions that I wanted to ask you also about this whole going from startup to scale up situation is, you know, what kind of processes you introduced when you realized that you're growing, and, you know, how do you actually define those objectives and, you know, identify them too?
So that's evolved a lot over the years. In the early days, it was very much, we just had an idea and we build it, right? We do it. We'd say there was no research that went into it. We're just like, let's try this thing out. So one or two customers might've asked for something. Let's do it. Now what we do is we essentially take time each year towards the end of the year to say, okay, what do we want to, is there anything we want to double down on? Is there anything that's working very well that we want to explore further? If not, then we say, where is the world as a whole going? Where is our industry going? We look and say, is there anything that we need to build or improve because the industry is moving in a certain way? So, and then we start collecting these into, what I usually do is I usually start writing up a document in Google Docs. And that document will basically be sort of the big ideas for the next year. So last year around September, October, I started writing down what are the goals for the company in 2025? What are the types of things that we need to see? And essentially we came up with three of them. And I'll just tell you right now what they are, because they're still on our objectives and key results right now. The first one was, we want to grow our enterprise customer base. So we want to do that. We don't want to stop having engineers who use us for their personal stuff. We love that. That's us. That's our core audience. And so we are going to keep building stuff there. But at the same time, we see a small drip of larger enterprises that are looking for alternatives to the big names. And we want to be able to foster that. So that was one of our objectives, is to grow the enterprise sales. The second was determining generative AI's place at DN Simple. And it could be at the end of the year, the answer is nothing external. We're just maybe using it internally for certain things. And then the third objective was, or is, removing single points of vendors failure, like basically single points of failure where we only have one vendor for a particular service, because we want to make sure that no one vendor can dictate our business, so that we have stability and longevity, right? We want to make sure that we're there for our customers. And there's always a risk of having one vendor who can basically say, well, we're changing everything and there's nothing you can do about it, right? We had this happen to us a couple of years back, where a vendor raised their prices by 7 times. So they like 7x their prices on, for us. And it was very, very touch and go for a while, because they're a major core part of what we do. And we said, wow, okay, we need to start looking immediately for figuring out how to mitigate this issue. And that's kind of just gone on afterwards. Like, once we saw that one vendor, like, what other vendors do we have where there's too much of a risk centralized around this one vendor? And so we have that as our third objective, is to prepare to make it so we disconnect ourselves, or we put layers of abstraction into any one vendor where they're the only vendor, so that if we need to pull in a second vendor in the same space, we can. And those are our three objectives for the year. And every year it starts off with, I write down notes and then I take it to the executive team. So I take it to the CTO, I take it to head of marketing, and I say, okay, here's what I'm thinking we're going to do next year. What do you all think? Do you want to add anything to it? And we talk about it, discuss it, make changes to it, evolve it. And by the end of the, by usually November, early December, we have our team meetup, and I'm ready to go to the team meetup and tell the team, here's what the plan is for next year.
All right. So you're kind of the definition of that calm business that just, you know, just kind of moves profitably and, you know, doesn't make any rash decisions. And that's pretty awesome. And I'm always wondering, you know, like, you've been around for 15 years, you've seen it all, you grew, you scaled, you have an amazing team. Like, what is the ultimate goal for DN Simple? Like, how do you see it? Is it kind of, I don't know, a generational kind of business? Do you just want to run it as long as it runs? Is there an exit? Like, what do you see, yeah, DN Simple in like 10, 20 years?
So I definitely can see the opportunity to have an exit at some point, assuming, and I've kind of put some thresholds on it. So some core ideas that in order to exit well, I would love to see. Of course, I have a number. Everybody has a number. If you don't have a number, then you're not really planning on exiting at some point. I'm going to keep that number private for me, but that's okay. But I have my own number in my head. But in addition, there's two, well, I would say three really folks, there are three groups of folks that I want to have a good outcome for. The first is the customers. I want to make sure that at some point I will exit. If it's not me, it's because I'm going to pass away. Like, there, you inevitably, every founder exits. And so my hope is that during that exit, I will find an outcome where our customers are still really happy with that outcome. Maybe, and ideally even more than they would be with me. I want them to go, wow, like after this exit, things are actually better. And then the second is for the team. I want to make sure that the team is taken care of, which is unique in our situation, I think, because we have such this distributed team. It's hard to find other companies that are very comfortable with that. So finding, if we were going to exit to another company, it'd be important to find that type of a company. And then finally, there are a couple other minor shareholders, and I want to make sure that they're very happy when we exit as well, because I want them to feel like their investment was worth what they put into the company. So if I can achieve that and hit my number, then I definitely would exit at that time. But I also don't feel it an obligation. I'm not really pulled by anything. So I'm a big fan of understanding what an exit might look like before actually doing it. I've read a lot of books on it from different folks, like John Warlow's books on it, and also Rob Walling came out with a book recently on it as well. And so I'm not, like, one of the things that typically will pull somebody, it will cause somebody to want to exit, is they're pulled by something else. Like, something else becomes so intriguing to them that they just can't, they have to follow that. So like, I need to get out and I need to go do that other thing. And I can't do that with running this business, because when you run a business, it takes up all of your headspace. You can't, I find it very difficult to, we tried to run a second business off to the side. It just is not easy. Let's put it that way. So I was like, so you get pulled by something and that will potentially lead to an exit so that you can go focus on another thing. I'm not pulled by anything right now. I love the space that I'm in. I go to these meetings about stuff. Yeah. So.
Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, I started thinking about this approach and I feel like it's very smart. And you know, there is this book called oh my God, it's a stupid name, but something like Good Girls Never Get a Corner Office. And I rephrased it in my head and just to tie it down to like your situation, founders who don't need to sell get the best valuation. I feel like now we need to trademark it and actually make a book. But that's such a good approach. And yeah, it's great to have that clarity. Like when we approach a founder, you know, asking like if they would want to sell ever, a lot of times they have no idea how. And, you know, you just said, if you don't have a number, you're not ready to sell. And let me tell you that very, very few have a number, or very few have, you know, a realistic kind of tied to a certain, you know, metric, or, you know, the point of at the company where it would be making any sense. So yeah, it's really interesting how you approach this. All right, I just have a couple more questions, to be honest. The usuals here, I sure always ask them at the end. And yeah, first of all, what has been so far the biggest win and the biggest failure? And it can be for the company or it can be for you as a founder.
So I would say the biggest win is basically when we got to the point where I could pay my own salary and take money off the table as well and feel like I actually had reached a very good financial point. So when I felt that I was comfortable enough so that I could lead that life that I was looking to lead, and DN Simple would provide that indefinitely, that was the big win for me personally. The biggest loss was the early in the company when my brother left. We did not leave on great terms. And I think that the loss there was that our relationship kind of soured and has never really, really recovered. But at the same time, it was also a massive learning experience in so many different ways. So, I mean, it's never easy to work with family. And in DN Simple, I've done it twice, because I worked with my brother in the early days. And now and always along the way, but especially now, I've worked with my wife in the business. And one worked out very well, which is the working with my wife. I love working with her. We have a really good working relationship. The one with my brother, not so much. So I would say that would be the hardest or the biggest loss, I would say, along the way.
All right. Well, but yeah, like you said, if it's a learning, then maybe there is still a lot of value there. All right. So the last question is always about a hack. And again, hack can be anything. It can be your personal, just how to go through, I don't know, 15 years, still be motivated and passionate about your business or mental health or anything. Or it can be something that really works for you guys, hiring, growth, anything within the business.
So I would say that my secret hack is about sort of, it actually gets both of those, which is keeps me motivated and engaged, and also slowly grows the business. And that is, I love going to conferences. I love speaking at conferences. I love attending conferences. I love the feel of being around other folks, whether it's for business or software, or it doesn't matter. I just love conferences. And so my hack is basically the going out to events, and no matter what situation I'm in, just going around and meeting people, talking to people, hearing about what they're, it gives me so much energy to hear what other people are doing. Even if they're not doing the greatest thing ever, you know, they're not trying to change the world, just hearing about the things they do with their lives and hearing and meeting people, like that's my hack. That keeps me motivated. And also it's been one of the ways DN Simple has thrived over the years, is by showing up in person at events, putting out booths. And if there's no booth, I'll go walk the floor and like give out something to people that are just hanging around. So I don't know. That's one of our guerrilla marketing techniques that I've always loved doing.
That's a cool one. I love events myself. Like, I mean, I'm very much into remote, but going and, you know, showing up, like you said, and just meeting people and seeing what folks are working on gets you, well, out of your bubble and into some great, very unexpected relationships. Like, there's so much serendipity at those events. And yeah, so I can really back you up there. All right. Well, thank you so much for telling the story. I absolutely enjoyed, the whole journey and your approach to hiring, especially. And looking forward to seeing what you're going to do next year and how those objectives play out.
Well, thank you for having me on, Anna. I really appreciate it. It's been a blast.
Same here. And take care.
That was yet another awesome conversation on SaaS Unbound. We're always looking for new guests to share their experiences. We mostly talk with bootstrapped SaaS founders, and if you're one, reach out to me directly at anna@saas.group or find me on LinkedIn. If you're not bootstrapped or even not SaaS but have a great story to tell, we want to hear from you too. And obviously, SaaS Unbound wouldn't be possible without the SaaS Group, a founder-friendly private equity company that buys awesome businesses that people love to take them to even greater success. If you're thinking about selling your company or just exploring your options, feel free to visit saas.group, fill in the form, and expect a response in under 24 hours.